tonight is really going to be history. Now, if you're one of those people out there who don't like history, tough. I'm a history professor, or at least I'm a recovering history professor. I retired last year. And but I think it's important for us as we think about the state of the church today, which is what I'm really going to be focusing on. As we think about that, it's important for us to know where we came from. Because if you understand the trajectory that has got us to this place, it helps you understand what's going on. Okay. So tonight we're going to be looking at the history of evangelicalism. Now, if you're not in an evangelical church, don't worry. There's a lot of things in this history that you'll probably also be able to relate to. Tomorrow, the first talk is going to be on worldview. It's a worldview conference. The interesting thing, though, is that in my experience, I've been working with worldview extensively since 2004, and in all that time, almost everybody who talks about worldview talks about the worldview of them. They don't talk about the worldview of us. So what I want to look at in the first talk tomorrow is what the real worldview is within the evangelical church. Because the problems that we run into in evangelicalism and the problems that we run into whatever your faith tradition may be in terms of your relationship to politics, it's rooted in your worldview. And there are some really, I would argue, very dangerous and defective things that are commonplace within the evangelical church. So that'll be the first talk tomorrow. The second talk tomorrow is what do we do about it? Now, we've talked already a bit about politics. Politics will enter into it. But I would argue that the fundamental issue that we're facing right now is not political. At least within the church, it isn't political. Politics is vitally important, and I endorse everything that was said up to this point. But if we're going to approach this as Christians, we need to think about what our Christianity means. So we'll be looking at, the internal challenges that face the church, then we'll move to the external challenges, the kinds of things that we might address through politics and getting involved that way. So that's where we're going. If you wanted me to follow the outline that I gave you originally, well, it's going to be there, but it's going to be done in a bit of a different order. So, okay, here we go. Let's start with the origins of evangelicalism. And where we begin here is actually prior to the evangelicals. When you look at Britain, and evangelicalism as we know it really arose in Britain. When you look at Britain in the late 1600s and the 1700s, what you find is a country where it's officially Anglican. But to quote a friend of mine who is an Anglican, he said, the beauty of being an Anglican is you don't actually have to do anything. The point being that because of the religious wars, the English Civil War, all of those kinds of things, being too excited about religion was seen as a no-no. This is a very negative thing. What you want are people who are baptized in the church, go to church on Sunday, get confirmed, get married in the church, and get buried in the churchyard. And that's about it. Anything more than that, any more engagement with religion, was really considered a social faux pas, something you just didn't want to do. And if you did show too much interest in religion, they labeled you an enthusiast, with a sneer in the voice. Enthusiasm was the British word for a holy roller, okay? Fanatic, something like that. Now, this is the world in which evangelicalism arose. What you see happening is, well, this is not a very effective way of thinking about religion. It doesn't really play any really significant role in people's lives. And a lot of people were really dissatisfied with that, and the Holy Spirit certainly was. So what you see happening is an outbreak of a series of revivals. In America, we know this is the Great Awakening. Okay, Jonathan Edwards, all of those guys. My church that I was at before I moved out of Connecticut was actually involved to some extent in some of the controversy surrounding the Great Awakening. Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, was preached two towns away from our church. Okay, so it, you know, this was a major deal in New England, also in the mid-Atlantic states. It actually helps lay the foundation for the American Revolution. That's a different subject. I can't get into that, but it's worth noting, without the Great Awakening, you probably don't get the Revolution. But it's not just in America. You see the Welsh revivals. There's an enormous series of revivals that take place across Wales on the island of Great Britain. Then in England, you get what is known generally as the Evangelical Revival, although frequently it's associated with the Wesleys and Methodists and so on. So you're suddenly in this world in which being too engaged with religion is seen as a negative. Suddenly there are these massive revivals that are sweeping through and transforming mostly the lower classes, because the upper classes have too much to lose socially. Now, when we talk about British evangelicalism, according to this gentleman, David Bevington, it has four characteristics. This is what set evangelicalism apart. First of all, conversionism. That is the idea that you need to have a conversion experience. You don't actually see this in the Protestant reformers. They believed that you could be raised in a church and sort of come to faith along the way, and you didn't need to have some sort of crisis-type conversion experience. Puritans tended to think that conversion was really important, and so from the Puritan tradition, you get this issue of conversionism, that in order to become a true Christian, you had to have a conversion experience. The second thing is activism. The idea is that just as an individual, when you are converted, you turn away from your sin, you turn to God, you start living a righteous life, society should do the same thing. So we should be active in society, promoting the good and opposing the evil. So evangelicals were social activists right from day one. Third point is biblicism, strong emphasis on the Bible. And we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, what this actually looks like, because American evangelicals' concept of biblicism and the British evangelicals' concept are really different. What does it mean to really believe the Bible? Two very different things. But we'll look at that more next time. And lastly, crucicentrism, that is to say, a real focus on Jesus' death on the cross. Okay. So these are the four things that, according to Bevington, I think this is a good definition of the evangelical movement early on. This is what it looks like. Now, as an example of this, let's take somebody who was not from the lower classes, because it gradually began to percolate upward, a man by the name of William Wilberforce. Wilberforce was a parliamentarian, best known for leading the fight in Parliament to end the slave trade. Now, it's worth noting that in Wilberforce's diary, he said, God has set before me two great objectives, the abolition of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. Reformation of manners, what does that mean? Well, manners, it meant something a little different in Britain than it does now. But when you think about manners, what are manners? It's how you treat other people. It's how you behave in light of the people around you. How you behave is shaped by what you think of the person that you're with. If you hold somebody in contempt, if you look down on them, you're not going to be particularly polite to them, right? It's just kind of the way these things go. If it's somebody you admire, you're going to be much nicer and much more polite. That's manners. Well, the Reformation of manners to Wilberforce meant changing the way people thought about other people, changing the way they thought about themselves, and changing how they thought about their place in the world. It's a complete reformation of, well, worldview. And he knew that this was essential because there's no way the slave trade could have been abolished without that. So Wilberforce was involved in something like 60 different philanthropic organizations, dealing with everything from helping women escape prostitution. 25% of the women in London were prostitutes when Wilberforce started. Okay, helping women escape that. He's one of the founders of the Royal Society for the Protection of the, for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I mean, he's involved in all kinds of things because he knew that the society was corrupt and it needed to be changed. And it is through that work that actually laid the groundwork for the abolition of slavery. Now, methodologically, what Wilberforce did, and I wish I had more time, but I can't go into this in any detail. Everything that you can think of in terms of an advertising or social campaign today, Wilberforce and company started. I mean, they even had the equivalent of bumper stickers, okay? Not, well, the equivalent, that's the key phrase there. They worked in every possible way to get the message out. You see one example there. There's a diagram of a slave ship, and what this is a literal diagram of how you packed the slaves in for transporting them across the Atlantic Ocean. They wanted people to understand the horrors that were involved in the slave trade. They started boycotts of sugar coming from the plantations that were slave run. They, you know, on and on and on, all kinds of different things. This is also going to be a characteristic of evangelicalism. We're really fast to pick up on new technologies, new methods of communication, new approaches to things. This is one of the things that you see here. Key point to note, though, is the amount of activism that's involved here. They're certainly involved in evangelism. They certainly believe in the importance of conversion. But they believe that just like the individual needs to be converted and turned from sin, society should be as well. Now, we see this actually in America as well. When you move into the 19th century in America, we see the Second Great Awakening, a series of revivals that swept across the country. There are some good and some bad things about this. There are a number of cults that arose actually out of the Second Great Awakening, Mormonism and things like that. But along with that, for our purposes, the thing to note is that they're also involved in social reform. Abolitionism is really big among the people in the Second Great Awakening, much like it was with Wilberforce. The temperance movement also starts during this period. Now, the temperance movement gets a bad name today. Prohibition didn't work, quote unquote. You might actually want to start looking at that a little bit more closely. Americans were known globally for being a nation of drunks. Okay, alcoholism was prevalent across the entire country. And the temperance movement was started to deal with something like their equivalent of our opioid epidemic. Okay, and by the way, prohibition actually worked in the sense that it broke the habit of alcoholism in America. And we've had much, much less of a problem with it since prohibition. One of the things nobody tells you in your history classes. Okay. But again, the point being, certainly evangelism, certainly revivalism and everything else, but it's coupled with social action. Now, another thing that happens during the 19th century is a development in theology. Now, when we're looking at eschatology, the doctrine of the last things, the doctrine of what's going to happen before the return of Christ, there are a number of views that are out there. You're probably familiar with at least some of this. What may surprise you is that the dominant view among evangelicals was postmillennialism. And the reason why, think about this, the postmillennial vision says that the gospel is going to succeed. The gospel is going to succeed and it's going to transform the world. And Christ is going to return then to rule this transformed world. There are variations on it, but that's the core idea. Think about the social activism that the early evangelicals are doing. This is partly inspired, not just, it's inspired, yes, out of love of neighbor, but it's also inspired out of this vision that the gospel has power to transform society, and that in the end, the church wins. The church doesn't lose. The Holy Spirit continues to work, and the church wins. It transforms society. The gospel succeeds. Now, a guy named John Nelson Darby comes along. Darby is the founder of modern dispensationalism. Started about the 1830s. Okay? And Darby's version of dispensationalism is a new version of another common view in church history of eschatology. He's got a new view of premillennialism. That is to say, Christ is going to return before the millennium starts. And in Darby's case, dispensationalism divides history up into discrete periods called dispensations. And there's a big chart that you can get that shows you what all of these various dispensations are within this system. And there's a very precise set of things that he believes will occur leading into Christ's return. This is where you get the tribulation and the great tribulation, and the rapture fits in there somewhere, and so on. Okay. The difference between dispensational premillennialism and postmillennialism is, in essence, the idea that in dispensational premillennialism, the church fails. The church does not succeed in winning the world to Christ. And in fact, things just get worse and worse and worse, despite what the Holy Spirit, the gospel, and the church are doing. It is essentially a pessimistic eschatology in terms of the church's prospects in this world. It's not usually presented that way, but when you think about the logic of the position, that's what it is. And dispensationalism gets a foothold, actually, in the context of Second Great Awakening, and it's going to grow in influence, but it's not going to become the dominant view for a little while, and we'll see why it becomes the dominant view later on this lecture and then in the following. Now, while all of this is happening, meanwhile, in Europe, right about the same time the revivals are taking place that I talked about before at the start of the rise of British evangelicalism, you also see the Enlightenment going on. There's a version in England. There's one in France, which is the most extreme in a lot of ways. There's one in Germany. This is an influential movement. It's got a lot of different, it's hard to categorize simply because it's complicated. In England, it looks really different than it does in France, for example. Of course, everything in England looks really different from France. Quick story, I just got to tell this. I lived in Paris when I was doing my doctoral work, and the most important person in the room was there with me, my wife. And right outside of our apartment, there was a marché, an open market, twice a week. And it was incredible, booths with all kinds of things. I counted 15 kinds of mushrooms at one of the booths. I mean, it's just incredible. And the first time it was there, we were out looking around, seeing what was there. And the vegetable booth right outside our door, the guy looked at me and said, he had heard me speaking to Lynn in English, and he looked at me and said, "Êtes-vous anglais? Are you English?" And I said, "No, nous sommes américains." No, we're American. As soon as he found out I wasn't English, I was an American, he started speaking English. And what he said was, "Oh, that is wonderful. I love America. Viva America. Viva America. I love America. I hate the English because of Joan of Arc. But viva America." My comment was, they want European Union when? But in any event, the Enlightenment period is known as the Age of Reason. And when we use the word reason, and as I use the word reason, it's got two different parts to it. One of them is rationalism, where you're using logic and things like that to reach conclusions. The other is empiricism, where you are looking for evidence, sort of the scientific method. And they believe that this was the way to find truth. Okay, you're going to find it through reason or through empiricism, nothing else. You don't need revelation, none of that kind of stuff. That's nonsense. And in fact, especially in France, you're going to find the Enlightenment was strongly anti-Christian. It was characterized, according to them, by superstition and bigotry and things like that. Now, there are reasons why they thought this. I'm not going to get into that. But this is the attitude that becomes pervasive in a lot of continental Europe during the Enlightenment. And again, this is going on at exactly the same time as the Great Awakening. It's going on at exactly the same time as the Wesleyan revivals and so on. So you've got two radically different directions that the culture is going. And the reason that is important is because, all right, here's a key principle of church history that nobody ever tells you. The church always exists inside of a culture, and therefore the culture always affects the church. It should go in both directions. The church should affect the culture, the culture should affect will affect the church. There should be a two-way street there, but inevitably the culture is going to shape the church. And so this anti-Christian bias that comes in here in the Enlightenment is going to have its effects on continental European Christianity. Now, another part of this that's coming out of this rationalism is the rise of a philosophy known as positivism. Positivism starts with the things you see on the left there. The basic principle of positivism is that all rational assertions, every rational statement, must be one of two types. It either has to be something that's scientifically verifiable, that's your empiricism, or capable of logical or mathematical proof, that's your rationalism. In order for a statement to be rational, in order for a statement to be valid, it has to fall into one of these two categories. Now, what that means is something like God exists is an irrational statement. It makes no sense because you can't prove it scientifically and you can't prove it logically. It is not logically necessary according to them. Therefore, it is a completely irrational statement. As a result, positivism is going to reject theism. It's going to reject any concept of God at all. And along with that, it's going to reject, well, this is a philosophical term we'll be talking about more tomorrow, metaphysics. That is to say, the question of what is the ultimate nature of reality? What is real? It's going to reject all of that. You can't prove it, you can't prove it empirically. You can't logically prove it. Any statement of that sort is irrational, is illogical. This is a direct assault on Christianity. And they very well understood that that's what they were doing. They were excluding Christianity as a subject that could possibly be discussed in any way rationally. Now, needless to say, we're also seeing during this period the rise of atheism. Now, there were some theologians out there who tried to respond to this. The probably most prominent of them is Friedrich Schleiermacher. You see his dates there. He wrote a book called On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers. And he published this in 1799. And Schleiermacher's basic point here is, yeah, you know what? When it comes to looking at the natural world, when it comes to looking at the external world, okay, you got me. Science is the way you understand the physical world. Yeah, that's right. Science, logic, mathematical proof, all that kind of thing, that works, but it's not the only way of knowledge. There is another kind of knowledge out there that you can reach, and that's what religion is for. You know, science and all that may explain the physical world, but there is a world beyond the physical that we can get access to through intuition, intuitive knowledge. We can get a kind of emotional experience and a connection, a feeling of being connected to the transcendent, this desire to be absorbed into the infinite. All of these kinds of really kind of nebulous, heady sort of ideas, emotion-based, that kind of thing. He says, this is a legitimate form of knowledge. The scientists aren't the only way, that works for the physical world. But there's also this sort of non-physical reality that you can get access to through religion, and that's why religion is important. Okay, so that's Schleiermacher. He's the founder of liberal theology, one of the key founders of liberal theology. What I want you to note here is the degree to which modern evangelicalism in America takes an approach inspired directly or indirectly by Schleiermacher. How much of our worship is designed to produce an emotional reaction? Let's keep that in the back of your mind. We'll come back to it. Now, things didn't stop with positivism. As a matter of fact, things got a little bit worse. You begin getting a movement known as scientism. Scientism says that scientific explanations, however implausible they may seem, are always superior to non-scientific explanations of anything. Scientific explanations, no matter how implausible they may seem, are always superior and to be preferred to non-scientific explanations. Thus, for example, and this is literally an example I've run into, when you're talking about love, love is a chemical reaction produced by hormones. There's a book called Molecules of Emotion. Okay? It is a chemical reaction produced by hormones in you, and that's about all it is. Love is nothing but biochemistry. Now, anybody who's been in love is probably going to dispute that point. But, you know, if you talk about, well, actually, even the metaphors that we use when two people, you know, sort of click, what do we say? There's real chemistry there. Okay? Within scientism, that explanation, however reductionistic it may seem to us, is far better than anything that refers to someone as your soulmate or, you know, whatever. Because there can't be anything that is not explained by scientific processes. That's it. So the world gets reduced to matter and energy. And the only explanation of anything ultimately involves physics as the foundation for chemistry and so on. Now, in response to this, now, I should note, one of the ways that this arises is because of a couple of ideas that emerge in the culture. One of the fundamental problems that in order to move toward atheism, one of the fundamental problems you have to get rid of is the beginning of the world. Because if there is if the world has a starting point, you have to ask what caused it to start, what came before that. They eliminated that problem by going back to the ancient Greek idea that the universe is eternal, it never had a beginning. So that eliminated, and then by the way, when Einstein's equations pointed to the Big Bang, the physicists were absolutely furious because they said, literally, if there's a Big Bang, there has to be a Big Banger. And they did not want there to be a Big Banger. So until actually the generation of physicists, the older generation of physicists died off, the Big Bang was unacceptable. It was the new generation coming up that brought it in. Because of this problem, if the universe isn't eternal, doesn't that open the door for God? And heaven knows we don't want to do that. The other one was human exceptionalism. Why are we different? Darwin took care of that. We're not. We're just animals that have evolved in one particular direction. So that's what opens the door to scientism. Now, once scientism begins to take hold, the next question is, well, what do you do about religion? You can't use Schleiermacher's emotional thing because the emotions are just chemistry. Well, what do we do? Well, the answer comes up with a guy by the name of Walter Rauschenbusch in a book called A Theology for the Social Gospel. He argued that what religion does is it provides an alternate role. An alternate role for religion is to provide you with a set of values. So religion is important because it provides you with a set of values, a code you can live by. Now, Rauschenbusch assumed, as did pretty much everybody else within the social gospel movement, that people are basically good. The problems that exist in society exist because of corrupt institutions. Now, the fact that these corrupt institutions are made up of basically good people, they never address. How you get there is not explained. But basically, the problem is society is corrupt, and what Christianity then does, because it provides you with this set of values, it provides you with the motivation and the direction for social action. So, the social gospel says Christianity is all about social action. Now, the problem here is that historically, Christianity had always combined two things, evangelism and social action. We see this in spades when we look at the evangelical movement. So what you get here with Rauschenbusch is he's throwing out half of what historic Christianity was about, salvation, forgiveness of sins, evangelism, those kinds of things, and just as wants to hold on to the other. Now, unfortunately, the conservative reaction was not helpful. What the conservatives said is the liberals are pushing the social gospel idea, that's not Christianity. Christianity includes the idea of forgiveness of sins. It includes the idea of the fall. It includes the idea of people being, well, corrupt. And we need to repent, and we need to have faith in Christ in order to restore our proper relationship with God. That's essential to Christianity. All of that is true. But then they made what I would argue was an incredibly bad move. They said, Christianity is not social action, Christianity is evangelism, and therefore we are not going to talk about social action, we are not going to get engaged in that because we don't want people to think we're advocating this liberal social gospel, and they reduced Christianity to just evangelism. And so you get what I would describe as a bifurcated gospel. The liberals take the social action aspect that had always been part of historic Christianity, and the conservatives take the evangelism aspect that was always part of Christianity, but they never reunite the two. And that split in the gospel, that split in the understanding of what Christianity is, well, it has devastating consequences. The liberal churches go completely off the rails theologically, and the conservative churches, well, let's see what happens with them. We'll start with something known as, we could start a little earlier than this. It turns out American Christianity was always a few decades behind what's going on in Europe. So you get all these trends happening in Europe, and American Christianity isn't really participating much. But by the late 19th century, American scholars at seminaries are going to Europe, to particularly German seminaries, where a lot of the liberal theology really has its origins. They're going there to study, and they're bringing these ideas back to America. And this is beginning to cause controversies within the various seminaries and within the denominations. And so probably one of the clearest early examples occurs within the Presbyterian Church, but it rapidly spreads to others. It's known as the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. And this involved bringing this bifurcated notion of the gospel to America. People are basically good. They don't need salvation. What we need is cleaning up the corrupt institutions within society. That's starting to make its way into seminaries. A lot of people are upset about this, and they start arguing with it. They start arguing, no, theology matters. No, evangelism matters, all of these kinds of things. And ultimately, they issue a series of pamphlets, eventually collected together under the title of The Fundamentals, a couple of volumes of these. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages in here in which they are trying to outline what the fundamentals of the faith are. This is basically historic Christianity. You know, it defends the virgin birth. It defends the resurrection. It defends miracles. It defends the authority of Scripture. It goes through, you know, it is defending the doctrines that the church pretty much had always held. We get our term fundamentalist from this. Technically speaking, the earliest usage of the term fundamentalist referred to someone who believed that Christianity was true, that historic Christian theology, historic Christianity was real, that this is actually the truth. Now, the liberals have got all kinds of reasons, they think, coming out of German scholarship, to question the authority of the Bible, and why should we believe any of this stuff anyway? And they start advocating, you know, Jesus's principle of love your neighbor and things like that, that's really all that matters. But it's going to boil over in a number of other areas. I would argue that the key event here is the Scopes Monkey Trial, 1925. In the Scopes trial, a little bit of background here. Tennessee had passed a law banning the teaching of evolution in the schools. Dayton, Tennessee decided that this is literally what happened. They decided that they wanted to get some good publicity for the town. They wanted to make the town known nationally. It was really a publicity stunt. And so what they did is they got a high school teacher, John Scopes, to teach evolution in the classroom. They convinced him to do this, and you know, he was on board. He knew what was going to be happening, and he was arrested and put on trial for violating the state law. The American Civil Liberties Union stepped in to defend Scopes, and then, much to the chagrin of everybody involved, a guy named Clarence Darrow inserted himself into the case. Darrow was a showboat lawyer. He was very good, but he liked to hog the spotlight. And Darrow turned this into a complete, well, the equivalent of a media circus. Okay. Defending the Tennessee law, they brought in a man named William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan was a very, very important populist figure in America. He had been Secretary of State for the country. This guy was really no slouch, and they brought him in to defend the law banning the teaching of evolution. Now, it's worth noting that opposition to evolution, we associate that with fundamentalism. But if you actually read the pamphlets and the fundamentals, one of them was written by a man by the name of James Orr. James Orr believed in theistic evolution. So it's not actually, even among the authors of the fundamentals, they weren't necessarily opposed to the idea of evolution. Undirected evolution, yes. But evolution directed by God, well, maybe that's how God did it. I mean, there were some people who were willing to go that far. Orr was one of them. So it's not a necessary connection, but it's one that the Scopes trial cements in the popular imagination. Now, when you read popular accounts of the Scopes trial, it looks like Darrow made a complete fool of William Jennings Bryan. When you read the trial transcripts, you find that was not the case. Bryan held his own. He did a very good job in defending it. Now, the question then becomes, where do we get this idea that Darrow just ran rings around Bryan and turned him into demonstrated that he was a fool. Where do we get that idea? We get that idea courtesy of H.L. Mencken, another name you got there. H.L. Mencken was a newspaper reporter, a genuine cynic, who had absolutely nothing good to say about historic Christianity. And his reports of the trial are incredibly distorted, but they are the things that shaped the Scopes trial in the popular imagination. And then this gets enshrined in popular culture through a movie called Inherit the Wind, which is what most people think the Scopes trial really was. It's fiction. It is really an incredible distortion of what had happened. In any event, Scopes was convicted because he did, in fact, violate the law. He was fined $25 or something that somebody else paid for him. And shortly thereafter, because of the publicity generated by the Scopes trial, Tennessee repealed the law. And the result of this, because of the publicity from H.L. Mencken and some others, but particularly Mencken, because of this, the entire idea of fundamentalism was discredited in the popular mind. These are a bunch of closed-minded, backwater hicks. Not true. But this is what people started to believe. And that, in turn, generated some other problems. First of all, one mainline denomination after another adopted liberalism. They just moved there. The liberals won. By the 1930s, they controlled the denominations, pretty much all the major ones, the mainline Protestant denominations, that is. They've taken over the seminaries. They've taken over the universities sponsored by these denominations. They controlled the publishing houses of these denominations. So the mainstream Protestant movement, Protestant churches in the U.S., go liberal. The fundamentalists, rather than fighting back, pick up their ball and go home. They form their own separate denominations. They withdraw from culture. They, particularly, I should note, academic culture, because they see academia now as the enemy, and you begin getting a strong anti-intellectualism within the fundamentalist movement, because the universities are all teaching, well, evolution, they're all teaching scientism, they're all teaching all these kinds of things. The universities are the enemy. We're not going to get involved in that. We'll start maybe our own private, you know, denominational colleges and things like that, but that's about it. We're not going to participate in the larger intellectual life in America. We don't want anything to do with American culture generally. We don't want people going to movies because they're terribly immoral. We don't want. So it turns into a reaction against engagement in the culture in any sense of the word. And this is the point at which dispensationalism takes over in the fundamentalist world. You get the premillennial pessimism that I talked about before, and with that, a rejection of culture and the world as being intrinsically opposed to the gospel, and therefore we must withdraw from it and do everything in our power to protect ourselves from it. This is why you get all of these strictures that are put in place in these fundamentalist churches. Basically, the faith becomes privatized. It is a personal thing. It's you and God. That's it. And as soon as you privatize your faith, you turn it secular. Secularism, a lot of different definitions, but the basic one says that, initially at least, church and state should be separate institutions. But then it goes to the next step and says, your faith should be separate from public life. There should be no connection between faith and public life. And that is what ends up happening. If you take this idea of secularization, your public life, public policy, all of those kinds of things should be purely secular. Religion shouldn't be involved in it. Religion, if you're going to have one, is something you should keep to yourself. What does the privatized faith that says that it's between you and God and it's about salvation, you know, forgiveness of sins, personal morality, going to heaven, and so on. What is that? It's a secular faith because it's privatized it and has nothing to say to public life. That was the fatal mistake that the fundamentalists made. And so that fundamentalist retreat is going to actually turn American culture over to liberal theology for the next 30, 40, 50 years. Then you're going to actually get a bit of a resurgence of fundamentalism / evangelicalism. But that's the subject of the next talk. We'll talk about how that happened. And with that, what I would describe as the rise and fall of evangelicalism, how evangelicalism emerged into mainstream culture, and what mainstream culture then did to evangelicalism. But that's the next one. Thank you.